everybody, and welcome to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and this week we've got Russ Chianelli back from his trips, and we've got a special guest whose name is Professor Kerry Hipps. He's from Washington State University up there in the Northwest, and he's going to be talking to us about, if you can believe it, tunneling. We'll find out all about that later, but Kerry, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you, Keith. It's a pleasure to be here.
And it's good to see you again. Kerry originally came from El Paso, but we'll get into that later. How did you become a scientist? What were those moments in your early life that said, hey, that's the career for me?
You know, I think I was fixated on chemicals from birth, probably. I remember in, in grade school looking, my father worked at what was Texaco Refinery at the time, and I remember looking through his manuals on the operation of the Texaco Refinery plant and things like, you know, cracking towers and hydrosulfurization and things like that, and I got interested in it. And then I found an old shed, and I built a laboratory in the old shed where I would do experiments, and some of them went well, some of them didn't. I was hospitalized once for chlorine-induced pneumonia. But
I didn't know that
sort of
story.
Sort of addicted to it from an early age.
You know, that's so funny because my dad took me into a refinery when I was about 12, and for the first time in my life, I've smelled H2S, and I fell in love with it, and I've been working with it ever since.
And my grandmother took me to a brewery once when I was about 6, and I fell in love with it ever since. Such are the stories of life.
Yeah.
So anyway, so your father was in Texaco down here in El Paso, right?
Yeah, he was, right. You know, he was foreman of the operations down there.
Okay.
None of my family had been college educated. I was the first one in my family to make the mistake of going down that road, but yeah.
And so then it carried on. You came to the university here in El Paso, Texas.
Here in El Paso. Did a B.S. in chemistry and physics. It wasn't why I came here in the first place. I thought I was going to be a veterinarian when I came here in the first place. But two of the faculty members who had long since gone, Dr. Rivera and an instructor by the name of John,
Ferraro.
Ferraro, that's right. That's right. Got me working in their analytical lab. You know, in those days they used these great big 30-meter spectrographs, and they do arc analysis, that kind of changed the direction I was going in.
Back, as far as I know.
I remembered how much I liked chemicals, and I wanted
Well, I wanted to ask you, you know, you had your own little laboratory, and I remember that too, and everybody out there has to recognize if you're a parent and your son or daughter is interested in chemistry, beware.
Yeah.
So what were the most dangerous experiments you did?
Well, I mentioned having to go to the hospital for chlorine-induced
pneumonia. Up.
That was before I had my shed. I actually locked myself in my parents' bathroom and was making chlorine gas in there, and it wasn't very well ventilated, as you might imagine. That got me into trouble. I also got really interested in things like explosives. You know,
oh, yeah.
Almost everybody who becomes a chemist at one point or another likes flames and loud noises. So. So
okay.
I did try my hand at making nitroglycerin at one point, and that didn't turn out too well. There was a wall in my shed that had to be replaced. But
okay, so then how did your career develop? It didn't develop into sort of noises and explosions.
No, it didn't.
Right.
What happened was is that after I got to college, not in high school, after I got to college, I became excited about mathematics. And the idea of using mathematics along with experiments to describe the physical world. You could have never told it from my grades in high school because they were terrible in math. They really were. But I got here and I wound up taking virtually all the math courses they had up through the engineering, applied math and advanced complex variables, that kind of thing. And the idea of combining math with experiments to understand it, it's just beautiful, you know, the way mathematics and nature interact with each other. So that's how I wound up moving towards physical chemistry. And then my first physical and chemistry instructor was Bill Wayland. And those were the days where you got a physical chemistry book that weighed 20 pounds and was a tome about everything everybody knew. This one was by Mulwyn Hughes. I don't know if you've
run absolutely.
Across it. But, you know,
absolutely.
A British tome.
Oh.
And It was just fascinating to me.
I had it, but never read it. I remember that much.
He used it for a doorstop. Right. Yeah, it's a big book. And then he offered me the opportunity to work in his laboratory. And I guess that was my first exposure to surface science. And there were a couple of interesting things about that exposure, but including one where we had a student from Formosa who was broke under the – he was a master's degree student. That's what they had at the time. And he broke under the tension of the program, went in and broke open all the mercury – you know, in those days you did everything with mercury, mm-hmm. right? I mean, big mercury manometers, barometers, mercury motion things for moving gas. He broke all of it and was sitting there eating mercury when we found
him. Oh, my gosh.
And it's not bad for you, really, because it comes right out.
Yeah.
It does. It comes right
out.
But
you mean he'd had a mental breakdown?
Yeah, he'd had
a mental
breakdown. And so
because he'd done something bad.
Well, no, he'd had before he got into the mercury, he'd had a breakdown over the tension of his coursework, not doing well in courses. And somehow he decided he was going to commit suicide by eating. I guess he wasn't any better at deciding how to commit suicide than his coursework. Yeah.
Boy, I remember playing with mercury when I was a kid, too. I think that was another thing that young chemists do.
Yeah. Lots of pennies turned into dimes and that kind of thing. Yeah.
Anyway, so you got into the surface science and you went away, you got a PhD, and then you started your own career.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, my PhD work and my postdoctoral work didn't have much to do with surface science. My PhD work was on, here's an early warning, this esoteric title, magnetically induced circular polarized emission. So I was looking at fluorescence and luminescence of transition metal complexes. And then for my postdoctoral work, I did microwave optical double resonance spectroscopy.
Both things that Russell and I are totally unaware of.
Yeah.
But
well,
never
weren't
mind.
You tempted by superconductivity when it came along?
It's the same way I feel about graphene right now. There's too bloody many people in that area already, and they have these big machines already running and the motors running. Unless you have some really unique little idea that you can do off all by yourself in a corner somewhere.
Right.
I don't think those are very fertile ground for young scientists.
I mean, that is, for the audience, one of the challenges of being in science, right? We did a guest on this program last week that was talking about his visits to China, right? And he's into photovoltaics, right? And he said, you know, you sometimes think you've got these armies of enthusiastic and efficient. It's not just that it's manpower. It's that they're good people. They're trained in Harvard and all around the world, and they've got the energy and the manpower. And sometimes you think you fear to go into the area because you can spend a few years, and all of a sudden you're ready, and then out pops that paper. And then that's pretty debilitating.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Yeah, but you got to be a bit of a free thinker, too. You know that
you can't be too defensive, obviously, but you can't put your...
In 2013, there had been 4,000 patents issued on graphene. Now, what's the problem? It's too expensive. If you can figure out a cheap way of making it?
Well, I think what I said is that unless you find your unique niche that where nobody's looking, right. It's not a good – if you can find that, it's great because now you've got 4,000 publishers all excited about your work and you get lots of citations and invited to lots of meetings. Yeah, so if you have something really new, go for it. Otherwise, I at least have always – hated following crowds in any way, personally. That's why I live up in the Northwest where the population's a lot less dense. So,
What's your niche in science and chemistry?
Okay, so generally speaking, so my research encompasses a lot of different areas of science, but they all have a common core around the concept of tunneling. And so maybe I should first tell you about what tunneling is. So we're all used to racquetball where we hit a ball and it hits the back wall and bounces back to you. And we're all used to the idea that if we fire a particle at a barrier, that it's going to either be embedded in the barrier or bounce back. Those are classical phenomena that hold down to the 10 to the millionth of an inch sort of scale. They're based on the fact that atoms have electrons surrounding them. They're nuclei surrounded by electrons. And when two atoms get really close to each other, those electric fields interact. Electrons are negative. Negative charges interact with negative charges. And that's not good. Takes a lot of energy. And so the particle bounces back. Now, we can get the energy really, really high and drive those particles through those interactions. That's what happens with gamma rays, for example, or X-ray particles. When you accelerate them at high energy into a barrier, you can get them to go a ways in. But generally, it takes lots and lots and lots of energy to make that happen. If the particles get really small, now we're talking about electrons now, really, really very small particles. And if the barriers aren't too thick, that is, if there aren't too many electrons packed per unit volume that the electron has to penetrate, the electron can actually slide through those electron clouds. Rather than having to have enough energy to sort of punch them out of the way, it can actually just sneak through those electron clouds to the other side. So it doesn't lose any energy. It starts out with some amount of energy, kind of slides through, and then appears on the other side.
It's sort of called magic, too.
It is. It's kind of magic. For those of us used to the classical world, it would be magic. In order for me to put a bullet through that wall, I would have to provide a lot of energy, and by the time it got to the other side, it wouldn't be moving nearly so fast. In the case of tunneling with really small particles like electrons and really thin barriers, the electron can actually sneak its way through and come out the other side with exactly the same energy.
And without perturbing much the interface that it's gone through.
Now that's it. That's what makes it interesting. Sometimes it does. And when it does perturb the barrier, then it comes out with just that much less energy. So, for example, if you excite a vibration inside the barrier, the electron comes out with just that amount of vibrational energy lost from it. So you can analyze the energy of the outcoming electron and understand what happened, what's going on inside the barrier.
Okay, so you're looking at the energy of the electron coming in, going through, subtracting the two, and then hypothesizing to a certain extent what type of energy has been translated.
Right, exactly. Exactly right. And so, in fact, that's the basis of what we would call a spectroscopy. You use a particle to probe the properties of the material. You look for energy loss or gain in the particle, and that tells you about the energy states, the discrete energy states. This is a strictly quantum mechanical phenomenon. To give you an idea of how it goes, if you take a block of gold the size of a Volkswagen, and I wish I had such a thing, and you measure its physical properties, its thermal conductivity, its reflectivity, its electrical conductivity, you get a set of numbers. If you only have 1 gram of gold and you make those same measurements, you get the same answer. If you have a milligram of gold, you make the same measurements, you get the same answer. Have a microgram of gold. But when you get down to about, 50 or 60 atoms of gold, the whole world changes. It's no longer gold in color. It's no longer a good conductor. It no longer doesn't react.
And we'll let you ponder on that phenomenon while we take a break. This is Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, here with Russ Kiernelli and also with Professor Kerry Hipps from Washington State University, talking about this wonderful piece of science called tunneling. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Neisel. Cheating is to act dishonestly or unfairly in order to gain an advantage. Most of us are guilty, and we've all certainly heard about behavior in politics and sports that would be defined as cheating.
So why do we cheat? A recent study found the primary motivator is dread, which is more powerful than the thought of a reward. Make sense? How averse are you to losing money, status, or a job promotion?
We knew from past studies that men cheat more than women. And it's not exclusive to humans. Even single-cell organisms cheat. Some bacteria steal products made by others. Viruses take over cells to make copies of themselves.
Among higher animals, the size of the brain's neocortex is associated with intelligence. And the larger it is, the more the animal exhibits deceptive behavior.
We're also learning from the new study that people who observed others cheating tended to cheat more. So cheating is contagious. It's also enhanced when the situation makes it easy for them to be dishonest.
Ultimately, people do it because they perceive real or imagined benefits. What's interesting about this is some research indicate creative people are likelier to cheat. Perhaps they're better at self-deception and rationalizing their behavior.
Because cheating wastes resources and lowers productivity, it needs to be discouraged. Research shows us harsh penalties don't work. Instead, people respond to education that emphasizes the cost and damage of cheating. And controlling it early in life is effective.
We can't prevent all cheating, but understanding it will allow us to limit this costly instinct.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russell Chianelli, Kerry Hipps from Washington State University. The topic is the magic of tunneling. So what are you doing specifically on tunneling? What are the objects of this phenomenon that you're using?
Okay, two different areas. One is in spectroscopy, that is learning about the energy levels available to molecules and atoms and solids and on surfaces. And the other is microscopy, actually taking pictures. And we can literally take pictures of atoms down to parts of atoms. We don't just see one atom moving like a dot. We see the internal structure, one molecule moving like a dot. We can see the atoms that make up that molecule. We can watch in time as other molecules come in, react with those molecules, and then come off again. And so
you're actually studying chemical reactions.
We're studying nowadays. We're studying chemical reactions one molecule at a time. We're actually taking pictures of these reactions.
Okay, now this is too good. So, what is the chemistry that you're looking at? What's the one reaction that you're really happy to be looking at?
Actually, we're doing a lot more than one because this is such a new area, the techniques that we've developed for doing it, that it's kind of like being in a candy store and having every flavor available to you, and you just grab whichever one's first, and then you grab the next one. So what we've been looking at right now are two very broad project topics, which are when is it kinetics? And when is it thermodynamics? And how do we know? Okay. So normally as 20th century scientists, we would make measurements like we'd look at the changes in the UV visible spectrum, or we'd look at changes in mass, or we'd look at macroscopic properties. We'd look at properties of the whole ensemble and try to deduce from that whether the system was at equilibrium or not. Sometimes it's hard. Diamond, for example, is a wonderful example. It's not only hard literally, but it's hard to understand that that's not the stable form, right? It's actually graphite that's the stable form at room temperature. And so if energy
was... We're talking now here thermodynamics.
Thermodynamics. If energy was just allowed to run downhill, which is what thermodynamics says happens, that diamond on your wife's finger would turn into a lump of coal and you'd be in big trouble. It's kinetics. It's the rate at which things happen that make that diamond valuable. It's changing, but it's changing so slowly we don't ever notice it. And
right.
People have this silly saying, diamonds are forever. Unfortunately, they're not, but that's okay. So that's thermodynamics. Kinetics is about a race. How fast can something happen? And so, for example, if you set a ball on a floor somewhere, right, and the floor is tilted, thermodynamics say the ball is going to roll down to the bottom corner of the floor. But there's a little bit of friction between the ball and the floor. Until you get that floor tilted enough to break that friction, kinetics says it's not going to move. And then it becomes an issue of how much energy do you have to put in to break the friction before you can start that ball rolling. Now when I know it's rolling, I can use thermodynamics to decide where it's going to wind up.
And for the real buffs out there, we can think of that as what we call activation energy.
Activation energy, exactly. So the problem is that we're trying to decide these very molecular things based on very macroscopic measurements. And we just get it wrong sometimes. What we're doing now is we're actually going in and watching the reactions one at a time so that I can show you pictures as a function of time to say, okay, look, this guy is going on and coming off. It's going on over there and coming off, going on over there and coming off. Clearly, there's a dynamic equilibrium going on between the surface and the surroundings. And I know that those measurements are average stationary in time, so I know that I'm in a thermodynamic equilibrium state. On the other hand, if you go and look and you don't see anything ever changing in the system, even though the quantitative values make you think it's at equilibrium, you know it's not. You know it's kinetically controlled. And the neat thing is now we can go in between. We can say it's 50% kinetically and 50% thermodynamically or something
that right?
Like that. Yeah.
Okay.
So that's really what we're having fun with right now is the idea of being able to look at individual molecular processes, not only get inside of how they're occurring by actually watching the molecule go on, but determining whether it's kinetics or thermodynamics that are controlling the process. And as such, hopefully one of these days we'll be able to come up with some principles that will let us beforehand say which it's going to be.
Okay, so you're the kid in the candy store.
Right.
But describe one of these candies for us.
Okay, so for example, there have been a bunch of papers in the literature about molecules adsorbing on metal surfaces from solution. Now, normally, when you think about a solution and a surface, you think of disorder, right? You think that the molecules sitting on the surface, if they're soluble in the solvent, are going to be going on and coming off, hitting at weird angles, maybe getting flat, coming off again. It turns out that in general, that's not true, that there's a very, very well-ordered layer of molecules right at the interface between the surface and the solution. And then the next thing you might think is, well, there may be well-ordered, but it's a dynamic ordering. There's molecules going out and coming in all the time.
There's a rapid exchange.
Rapidly exchanging. And for some materials, that's true. For others, it's not true at all. For others, once those molecules hit the surface, they stick. And it's not because of bonding. It's not these have no bonds with the surface. It's strictly physical interaction forces that are holding them on there.
So give us two examples of one that is dynamic and one that is not, that we might know.
So unless you're a chemist, I'm not sure you'd know, but I can try. Let's see. So something like benzene, some organic solvent, gasoline maybe, something like that, on a metal surface at room temperature is coming on and off really pretty fast. And you can get images of it, but you can also tell the way the images are formed that it's not the same molecule every time, coming on and off. On the other hand, something like a porphyrin. Porphyrins are, for those of you who are biologically inclined, they're the active piece of hemoglobin, of red blood cells. They're the active piece of chlorophyll. They're the active piece of myoglobin.
It's the piece in the middle that holds the metal that's in there that is the active species.
That does the reaction that you're interested in. Those porphyrins, when they go onto a metal surface, they stick unbelievably strongly. Even though they're in a solution where they're well below saturation levels, they don't come back off. They go on, they stick, and they'll actually deplete all the molecules out of the solution going on to the surface.
Now, I mean, being a bit of a chemist, if I was to take multiple benzenes together, so I get up to naphthalene, which is mothballs, or anthracene, then they begin to act like the porphyrins because it's a bigger pi system.
Yeah, by the time you get to like coronene, which is six benzene ring, basically.
That behaves in
that's
a similar
beginning.
Method.
It's still not as strongly adsorbed, but it's similar in its behavior at room temperature. Yeah.
So this is a fascinating new area.
Yeah.
And does it matter what the metal is?
Yeah, it does. In fact, and the chemistry matters too. And that's a really exciting thing. Remember, I told you we also do thermodynamic issues. So one of the thermodynamic problems we've been looking at is oxygen fixation on cobalt complexes. Oxygen won't attach to cobalt complexes in fluid solution unless they're specifically designed. Myoglobin, take the iron out of myoglobin, put cobalt in. You can get that to bond oxygen at room temperature in solution. There's not much else. If you put it on graphite, though, it binds oxygen.
Graphite, just the regular graphite, old stuff
carbon
that everybody
double
knows.
Bonded, right. Looks like benzene rings, except there's no hydrogen.
Pencil anymore. Lead.
Yeah, that's right, pencil lead. Put it on graphite, on the other hand, and it binds oxygen really well. And the reason is that those electrons from the underlying graphite are donating electrons to the cobalt, which then can donate electrons to the oxygen and form the O2 minus that's the stable species on the surface. You try to do that with gold, and gold isn't a good enough electron donator. It doesn't work. The oxygen won't bind to the cobalt on a gold surface. So it very much depends on the substrate.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know this. It's not an area I'm cognizant of.
Well, what's interesting about that to me listening to this is that you're doing all these experiments at room temperature, okay?
And higher and lower both, yeah.
All right. Well, if you take one of these porphyrins, which are related to these bad parts of crudes, they poison the catalyst if it's a metal. They stick. You know, now we're talking about 300 centigrade or something like that, okay? And the other thing that happens that we've published and it recognizes, if you take one of these materials on the catalytic reacting system, it reacts with the environment and it forms a core that's now stable. For example, sulfide surface is a carbide. So that it depends. What you're talking about is extremely interesting, but it also depends. It may react more if it's higher temperature.
Oh, absolutely. And so, yes, that does happen, in fact. It changes dramatically. And in the case of the porphyrins, it goes from kinetic to thermodynamic control at about 120 degrees centigrade. So you got to get it really hot before you can get it to start to approach thermodynamic equilibrium. So temperature plays a big role.
I mean, this is great. I mean, and as you say, you're the kid in the candy store. What do you think, you know, you still got a good career ahead of yourself, 10, 15 years, let's say that, something like that, at least. what do you see as the ultimate goal? What do you see as that prize on the horizon for you in this type of work?
You know, it's funny. I've always been driven by curiosity.
Understanding. Yeah.
Yeah, understanding. And not that I want to reduce it in the importance applications, because they're very important.
But, I wouldn't know. I've never had any.
But for me, it's always just been, how the heck does that work? You know, I mean, that's really why I'm into it. And so in some ways, I just see us going further and further with this. Because, for example, in catalysis, there's always been the issue of where is the reaction really going on?
Yeah.
You know, so modern heterogeneous catalyst, something they use in the refinery, we're going back to my childhood, right, might be metal particles on an aluminum oxide surface. And nowadays, it might be a mixed metal particles on aluminum oxide surface. And the question becomes, is it on the edges of those metal particles that the chemical reaction is going on? Is it on the terraces, on the flat parts?
Right.
Does the substrate, does the oxide have something to do with trapping stuff and feeding the catalyst? Well, always before, the only way we could answer those questions was through some general ensemble measurement and sort of waved our hands and said, well, because of this and that and the number of them. Now we can literally look. We can watch the reaction going on at the edge. We can watch the reaction going on at the terrace. We can watch the reaction going on next to the metal particle. And we can do it under high pressure, or we can do it under fluid solution, something that you just couldn't do before.
Well, I mean, Kerry, this is very exciting, and you're in the forefront of a nice area. But as the audience has heard, it's driven by curiosity.
Yeah.
All right? And in a sense, that's got to be the key to what brings a scientist into science. Curiosity, and then if you find application, so much the better. If you don't, you've created a lot of knowledge for other people to go to develop. I mean, that's the way I look at it. Huh?
There are people, I think, though, who are driven into it by the application. And usually I say driven because it's something really, really strong in their lives. A parent who maybe died of cancer.
Well,
or something.
Well, also, you know, if you're a scientist, you know, maybe you ought to give something back to the public, not just sit in your lab and publish.
Touche, Russell Chianelli. I think we've come to the end of Science Studio. That's a good place to finish. Kerry Hipps, Washington State University.
Thank you
very much for being here. A lot of fun.
Thanks for being here, and thanks to Dennis Wu, our producer.
And thank you for the audience for listening. Without you, there's no program. Bye-bye. Mm-hmm.